in. Nicholas Batts applies out of the touchdown. Reese Kellogg never saw it. It's 4-1.
Hello and welcome once again to the Power Play Point podcast. This is the Blue Liner on Point. And we are on to show number 5. And we're going to wrap up the trade deadline doings, or lack thereof,
boring,
as it were. And this past month being February, of course we're in March now, but past month being February, going to do our Black History Month special, focusing on the man who broke the NHL color barrier, Willie O'Ree. But before I get into everything, I just want to do a little bit of housekeeping. Housekeeping. I do podcast. I talk about hockey. You listen. Housekeeping. I do podcast. Hello? Housekeeping. All right, that's enough of that. Okay, what I wanted to make sure I get done, in college I was a history major, so the one thing they teach you is you cite your sources, you give credit where credit's due. So for my historical period this month, I drew on three websites, three really great websites. The first of which, brought by a history professor named Dr. Garth Vaughn. And his website is birthplaceofhockey.com. And the main focus of that site is all the historical evidence that makes the assertion that Nova Scotia is the one true birthplace of hockey, where hockey as we know it today was first invented. The second website belongs to a writer by the name of Mike Walsh, wrote some very good novels, history novels in particular. But he also wrote a very good article on Willie O'Ree that I drew from called Soul on Ice. And if you want to check that out, the website address is Mission Creep, all one word, MissionCreep.com/MW/ORE.html. Check that out for more information on the story of Willie O'Ree, his life story, his hockey career. And finally, third website I drew from for some information about the careers and accomplishments of other black hockey players was Joe Peltier's site, and that's greatesthockeylegends.com. And like mine, it's a blogger.com site, so we have that in common. I wish I had this guy's website. It's absolutely fantastic. It is one of the it's one of the greatest hockey websites I've ever seen. If you know me by now, I'm absolutely in love with hockey history. And so if you ever go there, you can literally just get lost in it with the wealth of stories about how the game used to be. And again, it's Joe Peltier's website, and it's greatesthockeylegends.com. Can't say enough good things about that site. It's absolutely fantastic. So there we go. That's the housekeeping. I want to make sure that those three gentlemen got their due, because they provided some really great information. They have some great information. Their websites, again, very much worth checking out. Please do so if you have an interest in hockey history, like I do. And all right, so let's get started. Now, the trade deadline, not a whole lot happened. Total of 16 trades. One of the fewest totals since the lockout. In fact, almost exactly half of last year's total. I think there were 31 trades last year. It was 16, counting the handful that took place before The biggest name that moved, of course, was Jeff Carter going from the Columbus Blue Jackets in exchange basically for Jack Johnson, defenseman Jack Johnson from the Kings. Rationale for that trade being Jeff Carter being able to provide much-needed offense for the Los Angeles Kings, who are pretty much dead last in scoring, last I checked. So if you listen to the Puck podcast, Eddie Garcia, who's a fan of the Kings, made the point that that may be more due to a system thing than a lack of effort or ability by the players. And so getting a guy like Jeff Carter, while on the surface might look good, probably won't pan out or turn up much in the long term. And if it doesn't, the bad thing is they're stuck with that huge contract because he's guaranteed. That's a guaranteed contract. He is signed for another 10 years. So if that doesn't pan out, they are stuck with that contract unless they can move it. So better them than us. And, we'll definitely discuss that in the second period. Little bummed that the Caps didn't really do anything, but again, get to that later on in the second period. Now, the other big name that was talked about was, of course, Rick Nash, also of the Columbus Blue Jackets. They were talking about maybe trading him to several different contenders. But as silly as this sounds, the bigger underlying story was which side initiated this idea of trading Rick Nash. Was it Nash's camp, or was it the Columbus front office led by Scott Housen, general manager Scott Housen? I'm not going to waste time talking about this ridiculous he said, she said argument over who wanted a trade, because it's really stupid. I don't even know why it's a story. But then supposedly so is the Columbus front office, because they turned down a huge deal from the Rangers involving basically two active players, one young player in their system picked from last year's draft, and two future draft picks. So five pieces for one player they were offered. And Scott Housen turned it down. I don't know how you can turn that down, but he did, and so Nash is probably not going to get moved until probably around draft day. So look for that. Speaking of the Rangers, a quick check of the standings. The Rangers are pretty much running away with the Eastern Conference. They're way ahead of the second place team, the Northeast Division leading Boston Bruins. And they look like one of the best, if not the best, teams in the NHL right now. So it may have been to their benefit that they didn't move anybody, that didn't make this deal, because their team as it is pretty good. So why mess with that chemistry? Taking a look over at the West, it's a little bit tighter race. Vancouver's on top in the West, but not too far behind. Maybe one or two points behind, last I checked, are the Detroit Red Wings, who, of course, rode that 24-game home winning streak for all it's worth. And ironically, of course, it was broken by Roberto Luongo and the Vancouver Canucks earlier in the week. So those are essentially your top four teams in the league right now. Now, are those the teams that are going to make the semifinals and then later on the finals of the Stanley Cup? Remains to be seen. As we all know by now, the Stanley Cup playoffs can be kind of a crapshoot at times. Now, taking a look further down the standings, one very interesting story is the Anaheim Ducks, who are, of course, led by former Caps coach Bruce Boudreau. They're making a pretty good playoff run, case for the playoffs themselves, and maybe not as furious as a run as his first year with the Caps, but ever since Boudreaux took over, they are 21-15-6. So pretty good for a team that was left for dead when Randy Carlyle was fired. So good to see that he landed on his feet and is doing well for a team that's now challenging for a playoff spot. Be good to see Timu Solani make the playoffs one last year. It's probably going to be his last season. So, the Bruce doing well. The Bruce. Need some dramatic music. You can just see him inspiring the hell out of the Ducks. Can't you just see him getting them, gathering them for that final push in this, now that we're at the last quarter pole? Just like Braveheart. Gathers everybody in the locker. All right, boys. You led with Carlyle. Now lead with me. Now get out there and play like warrior birds. Okay, that was probably really bad. But you get the idea. They're definitely a team to keep an eye on. So, it's gonna be a very interesting last 20 games. Of course, the Caps are in a playoff dogfight of their own. Like I said, we'll get to that in the second period. And, we're gonna wrap up this first, with a bit of sad news. Of course, back on Monday, it's announced that Jean Béliveau, suffered a stroke, that night. I haven't seen any, updates on his condition, but he continues to undergo treatment in a Montreal hospital. Still hospitalized, as far as I know, undergoing treatment and tests. And of course, everyone in the hockey world, all our thoughts and prayers are with Jean Béliveau and his family. If you don't know him, he was a centerman with the Montreal Canadiens. Played 20 years in the league. One of the most very physical yet elegant in his style of play. One of the classiest people you would ever want to know. Still active in the Canadiens front office, Canadiens alumni, and one of the best ambassadors of the game we could ever have. So again, all our thoughts and prayers are with him and his family, and we wish him a speedy recovery. Okay, let's get started with the second period, and of course, talk about the Caps and their struggles. constant struggle, it seems to be, this season. And what they did at the trade deadline was absolutely nothing. Nothing but put Nicklas Backstrom on long-term injured reserve. And that happened, that actually happened early on deadline day. So we all thought that would be the precursor to quite a few moves, because moving his salary to long-term injured reserve would have made room. They were up against the salary cap, but that would have made some room for some dealings, so we thought, but as it turned out, nothing. So my main point being that George McPhee, I felt, had to do something, but yet did nothing. Now, you can make the argument that his hands were tied by the fact that, well, there really weren't that many attractive offers out there. There really, he basically said that he didn't see any significant deal out there to improve the team. And that's a fair argument, actually, because if you think about it, the players, the only players out there that were really worth having, they pretty much would have had to gutted the team or mortgage the future to get. Although I thought they might have, they could have made a stronger play for Antoine Vermette, who ended up going to the Phoenix Coyotes. Can never have too much depth at the forward position. Never have too much secondary scoring, which, you know, Caps are always desperate to get. But it just, given the state of the team, though, you were just, I think we were all hoping they would do something, but he didn't. And if you think about it, there's no way this team as it is now, doing the things they do, is going to make a significant cup run, let alone make the playoffs. Not to throw a white flag on the season, but that's where this team is now. It's just, they're just not playing well. A coaching change hasn't helped, hasn't made any difference at all. In fact, you can make the argument that the team has been worse since the coaching change. Now, as for what happened on deadline day, well, okay, I can appreciate the fact that George McPhee was stuck between two potentially bad choices. Well, those being doing nothing at all, standing pat and going with what you got, which obviously hasn't been working, or gutting the team and making things worse. Trading away some significant pieces and possibly making things worse. The only other choice at this point is to wait until the offseason to make any moves. And, well, that only presents more questions than answers at this point. So, especially when you think about the fact that there are at least four potential unrestricted free agents, UFAs, that at this point are probably going to walk for nothing. Going to let them go for nothing. Absolutely nothing in return. Not to mention Mike Green, who's a restricted free agent. I don't think the Caps have quite figured out what to do with him. But it just makes absolutely no sense to me when you had a lot of teams that were potential buyers and a time period where the price is artificially high. You know, at the very least, get some decent draft picks, get some extra draft picks, maybe package everybody together for a quality second line center, as if there were one out there. And this was probably George's logic. sense that there just weren't that many quality players out there available. But even after all that, the power play is still a problem. One of the biggest problems with the team is the power play. And that's still horrible. And as I mentioned this, I asked this in the blog, my last article, after the New Jersey debacle. For a team that's supposed to have more of an emphasis on defense, why are they still giving up 5 goals a game? And don't tell me it's all on bad goaltending. It's not. Sure, the goalies could be a lot better. But you can't tell me, you cannot tell me a team that is supposedly more defensively responsible is going to give up 5 goals every other game. That's just ridiculous. And that's a team that's not listening to its coach. That's a team that's not responding to its coach, not responding to a new system that they're supposed to be playing. And that's not a team that's going to respond to the urgency that is this playoff run. Now, granted, they were on a bit of a winning streak and won 3 straight games, but when you consider the quality of their opponents, yeah, they should have won those games. Toronto, the Islanders, Montreal, all teams that are currently out of the playoffs. Toronto just recently fired its coach. That's how bad off they are. So, of course, they were supposed to win those games. Every time you think they turn the corner and they're starting to play well, they're starting to get it together again, they put up an effort like they did against the Devils on Friday night. I don't know what it is. I really don't know what it is. But somebody who has a little insight into what it might be, a good friend of mine, Ross Hollabaugh, went to high school with him. He has his own website. It's the rhsportspub.com. Pretty good site if you check it out. Covers anything and everything DC sports. Pretty good website. Lots of great photos, lots of great articles. Anything you'd ever want to know about sports and entertainment in and around the DC area. Absolutely fantastic website. I've got a link to it at my blog. But anyway, I was chatting with him the other day, and here's his take, and this is a direct quote. I asked him what he thought was wrong with the Caps. His take on it was, and I quote, "The pressure of too much success too quickly took a toll on everyone. As the team went from intimidating offensive dynamo to a middle-of-the-road defensive," he puts defensive team in quotes, "the wheels fell off, and everyone, that being players, front office, coaches, and fans, lost their sense of identity." Where have we heard that before? And other than the couple of months the team had Jason Arnott, there is no veteran leadership for the young players, that being Ovi, Semin, and Green, to sponge off of. A possible exception as far as leadership, he cites, after that quote, was Brooks Lyke, of course. But there you have it. I think what he's trying to say is the Caps tasted success so quickly and they pretty much thought everything else would be a walk. Well, it's not. And then when They faced adversity. Instead of sticking to their guns, they decided a change was in order. And that's when they started losing their identity. They started losing who they were. That's why Semin's not scoring as much. Ovechkin's not scoring as much. They switched back to a defensive mode. They basically said, well, what we were doing... Now, think about it. When you go through and you have so much success doing things a certain way, and then you come to realize, well, it's not enough, then you end up having to change, that hits you where you live. That affects you. That affects how you approach the game. And basically they're saying, well, what we were doing isn't working. So now what? Now, obviously, injuries play a factor in this. The loss of Nicklas Backstrom was significant, of course. Still is. And what's scary is there's still no timetable for when he'll be back. You've mentioned Sidney Crosby a few times in the past, and he's still the best example of what can happen when you have a concussion. It is just absolutely no way. There's no way to predict how long it'll be before you can return to full-time duty. So, yeah, there's that, but the fact of the matter is, teams face injuries. All teams have to deal with injuries at different points in the year. And the best teams are the ones that can adjust, that can have their, if it's the best players that are hit, that can have their secondary scoring rise to the occasion and take over. Now, I will say this much. I've noticed that Matthew Perreault, for one, has elevated his game. And so if there's a bright spot, that's one of them. So that's something to hold on to there. But I want to take the conversation into another direction. I did say before that the coaching change hasn't made much difference. If anything, the team has gotten worse. Well, that's a good part of it, is just the team is just not responding. I'll give them that. And I don't knock Dale Hunter's abilities. Obviously, his success in the junior league can't be argued. He's won, I believe it's at least one Memorial Cup up there. So he can't argue with his success as a coach at that level, but you really have to wonder what he's doing sometimes when he, it's hard to argue with benching Roman Hamrlick. I'll give him that, because he hasn't been playing well all year. I think he's been a bust. As far as a free agent signing, I'll get to that later. But it's kind of like when you're a kid, and when you're a little kid and you're getting dressed to go to school, and you got to wear what your mom lays out for you, and even if you don't like it, you got to put it on. You have no choice but to wear it. And you know, it's absolutely horrid looking. You know, maybe grandma knitted you a sweater that's just, glows in the dark or something like that, but you got no choice. And you gotta go out in public and do it. And to me, that's what this team looks like at times. They look like a team that's forced to put on an act and put on some clothes that they don't want to wear. Now, when by nature you've got talented guys like Semin and Green and and Ovechkin that are used to playing a certain way, and I don't think even after a whole year, let alone the time that they have had with Hunter, that they would ever get used to this system. Now, should they play a little bit more defensively responsible? Absolutely. But it's like they're being forced to play with blinders on with one arm tied behind their back. For all the offensive talent we have, it's just not coming to fruition. For all the offensive talent they have, why isn't the power play any better? It's not. It's absolutely a joke now. The power play used to be the difference in all the games. Now it's a joke. And worse, they're giving up shorthanded goals. So it seems to me that the system just doesn't fit. And so don't be surprised at all if Dale Hunter ends up going back to London, back to juniors, back to his old team. It just doesn't seem to be a good fit. And that's, if you can blame George McPhee at all, maybe not blame him so much for being inactive at the deadline, but the debacle really started last offseason, because just about all of his free agent signings, with the possible exception of Jeff Halpern, have been absolute busts. Joel Ward, I like the way he plays, but he basically signed him to a free agent deal based on one playoff season's worth of performance. And you never do that, because you still never know what you're going to get. Joel Ward's a pretty good player, but, you know, unless you get him into the playoffs, you can't see what he's going to do. And that, I think that's what George McPhee did. He built a team that was supposed to be able to win in the playoffs, but kind of sort of forgot that you have to get into the playoffs first. And then came the coaching change, and that's when the wheels really fell off. It's just losses like the one against New Jersey, you know, scream out loud the fact that this team just isn't going to go anywhere the way they are. And I don't know if it's they need a new coach. I don't know if they need to bust up the team. I don't know what the cure is. It's easy to spot all the problems, but nowhere near as easy to fix them. And it just looks to me like they need a fresh new start. Does that mean a new face in the front office? Does that mean McPhee's out of a job? Possibly. It could be that that's what they end up doing, but hard to say at this point. But Roman Hamrlich, getting back to the free agent, Roman Hamrlich's been a bust. I honestly don't know the logic between that, but, you know, of that signing. That made no sense. I guess the thought was, can never have too many experienced defensemen. Well, they weren't too happy with him in Montreal. I think they were pretty glad to see him go in Montreal, as I recall. So why signing? I guess McPhee thought he was the best free agent defenseman available, and that's just, you know, but he just hasn't worked out. He hasn't been a good fit for the team. And then you have Tomas Vokoun, who has been absolutely brilliant, but only in fits and starts. And, you know, this shouldn't be anything new to him. He's been traded before. He's moved around before, but it's just for some reason he can't seem to get on the ball. He can't get his head together as far as this move goes. I know he's away from his family. They're still in Florida. I understand all that, but there comes a time where you have to suck it up and be a pro. And if that's what the problem is, you know, I, I, I don't don't know. And the other adverse effect of that was you stunted the development of Michael Neuwirth. And Neuwirth was supposed to be the go-to guy. Neuwirth is the homegrown talent. And he proved last year that he was the number one. He was capable of carrying the load. Basically beat out Varlamov for the number one job. Well, now you call in this experienced other goalie who gets handed the number one. Maybe he earned it in training camp. Maybe he didn't. Don't know. But it was implied that he earned the number one. He got the number one. So what does that say for your guy that you relied on all last year? No, it stunted his development. And basically, you know, this is a year that Neuwirth is not going to get back. But it looks like for the time being, they're going to ride him into whatever fate befalls this team. You know, playoffs or bust. I think looks like Neuwirth is the guy. But I think Neuwirth should have been the guy all along. Like I said, the only free agent I think that has worked out to any degree is Jeff Halpern. And I honestly hope he stays out and re-signs and retires a cap, because this is where he belongs. He's probably the best story the team has. Potomac, Maryland native, played for the junior caps when he was a kid. Those of you who don't know his story. And so I hope he sticks, because not only is he a great story, he's a hell of a player too. And he's one of the best face-off artists in the league. And as we've seen, when the chips are down and you have to win a key offensive zone draw, he's your guy. He is definitely your guy. Brooks Light is no slouch either, but you definitely want a guy like Halpern who can get low in the dot, crouch down like he does, and just absolutely dig in, and you just cannot move him off the puck. And there aren't too many players that are better than he is at digging it out, moving that thing backwards out of harm's way, and making sure his team gets the possession right off the draw. But, you know, whole lot of problems with this team. It's going to continue to be a struggle. I hate to sound pessimistic, but short of Nicklas Backstrom miraculously recovering from his concussion symptoms, there's going to be more of the same. There's going to be, at best we can hope for at this point is if the team puts together two wins and then a loss, and then take a step forward and then take a step back. You know, if they can win, they can spring together, obviously, more wins than losses. They just might squeak into the playoffs. Are they going to win the division? Unless Florida collapses, I doubt it. I don't see Winnipeg winning the division. But unless Florida has some sort of major collapse, I doubt they're going to get in. But that doesn't mean, given the fact that Toronto is failing and Winnipeg has as much trouble winning or springing together a significant winning streak, I think the eighth seed is still very much alive. And then after that, who knows? Because we always play the Rangers real tough, although they look a lot better this year. As I said, they're running away with the Eastern Conference. That's obvious. But as has been proven in the past, you get in the playoffs, anything can happen, you can do some damage. But unfortunately, the struggles continue. It's been one long struggle, and there's no end in sight of it. So this coming month of March obviously is going to tell the tale. Will they make the playoffs or not? Hard to say, because they still look good in flashes. It's just a matter of which Caps team is going to show up. Okay, and of course, all know that sound by now. That means we're going to climb into our Wayback Machine, courtesy of Mr. Peabody. And this past month being Black History Month, going to celebrate the contributions of those of African descent to the wonderful sport of ice hockey. And, of course, the centerpiece of which is going to be one Willie O'Ree, who broke the color barrier in 1958 with the Boston Bruins. But as I was pleased and amazed to discover the history of African-Canadian participation in the sport of ice hockey runs much richer and deeper than that. And the origins actually go back to, all the way back to, the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century. The first organized colored hockey league, the Colored Hockey League. And it was actually the brainchild of several Baptist ministries all throughout some of the Maritime provinces, especially in Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island. And the motivation for the league was to encourage young black men to be more active in the church congregations, to join retained black young black men as members of the Baptist church congregations. Provide for them an activity, something for them to do, to as part of the church groups. Now, of course, it wasn't exactly a major professional or even a major amateur league, but they were very innovative, and they pretty much played for fun. And they, in a testament to the athleticism and how entertaining these games were, these games often drew crowds that numbered in the hundreds, upwards of thousands, and a lot of the spectators were white, interestingly enough. But even more interesting than that, that I found, was that the Colored Hockey League was the first organized hockey league to allow goaltenders to drop to the ice to make a save. Now, if you remember, in the very first Power Play Point podcast, very first historical segment, we talked about how the phrase "that goalie stood on his head" came about. That was because of the rule change. But that was in 1920, in the 1920s. Here, you have a league two decades before that had the idea to allow the goalies to display the utmost in athleticism by doing their most, by dropping to the ice, allowing them to fall to the ice to make a save. No other league allowed that, and they were way ahead of the curve, way ahead of their time. So it was a very, as you can imagine, very entertaining game to watch, the way they played it. Jumping ahead a few decades, the first African-Canadian player of renown that had a significant amount of skill that gained some notoriety was a guy by the name of Herb Carnegie. And he was known in what was then the Quebec Senior League. And he actually caught the eye of one Jean Béliveau. We mentioned Jean Béliveau earlier, unfortunately having a stroke and being hospitalized. But he also got his start in the Quebec League, and he marveled at how fast and how skilled Herb Carnegie was. And Herb Carnegie actually ended up leading the Quebec League in scoring three straight years from 46 to 48. And it was after that 48 season that he actually earned a tryout in the New York Rangers system. Unfortunately, he was offered less money than what he was earning at the time. And you can speculate that may have been because of racism. That could have been. But he pretty much, he flat out turned down that offer because of that, because he's actually making more money in the Quebec League than he was offered at the time. So he finished out his career. He actually played on a line called the Black Aces. He was a winger, and his brother Aussie was another winger, and they were centered by Herb was actually the center. His brother Aussie was the right wing, and another African Canadian player by the name of Marty McIntyre was the left wing. And so in the Quebec League, that was the most feared line for their skill and their speed. And they turned a lot of heads. And they were all three of them African Canadian, so they were called the Black Aces. So now we're going to talk about Willie O'Ree and his contribution, how he ended up being the man that broke the color barrier in the NHL. Willie was born on October the 15th, 1935, in Fredericton, New Brunswick, another Maritime province. And he was a right winger, left-handed shot. And like Herb Carnegie before him, started making a name for himself in the Quebec Provincial League, Quebec League, in the Boston Bruins system. And he got his break in 1958 when he was called up for a couple of games for the Boston Bruins. His first game took place on January the 18th in the 57-58 season, and it was against the Montreal Canadiens. He played the next game and then was sent back down. Unfortunately, didn't really distinguish himself. Played two games, no goals, no points, no assists, no penalty minutes even. But still, it was a significant event in that the unofficial color barrier had been broken. And they called him the Jackie Robinson of hockey, but O'Ree, who was to this day a very modest man, said, "Well, they call me that, and I understand I'm being, that I'm the first, but there really weren't that many obstacles that I had to face compared to what Jackie had to face," is basically what he said, what his thoughts are in reaction to that. So he was aware of his historical significance, but didn't make or tried not to make too much of it. Now, he toiled in the system for a little while longer, finally catching an even bigger break a few seasons later in the 1960-61 season, where he was called up for two-thirds of the season, ended up getting into 43 games, and scoring a respectable 4 goals and 10 assists for 14 points, and collecting 26 penalty minutes. He was put on a line with Don McKenney, the center, and left winger Jerry Toppizzini. And they proved to be a pretty decent, pretty reliable combination. Now, before I go any further, one pretty remarkable thing about Willie O'Ree. In addition to his being black, he had a physical obstacle to overcome, and that was the fact that he was actually 95% blind in his right eye. This came as a result of an accident. He was hit by a puck in that eye 2 years before his call-up to the NHL. And his doctor told him he would never play again. He would never be able to see properly out of that eye, so he could never play again. Well, what he did was he kept the injury to himself, didn't tell anybody, and made the adjustment, made enough adjustments so that his good eye would always be on the side of the puck. Because he found that when he came back to play, he would get hit. He would get knocked off the puck very easily because he couldn't see the other guy coming. So he switched wings and made sure that his good eye was always towards the ice, towards where the puck was coming, so that he can anticipate the play better. And he just happened to be one of the fastest players in the league. So his speed made up for any half second of timing that he lost due to his diminished vision. Now, as for the racism he faced, he noted that racist remarks were always much worse in U.S. cities than, of course, in the Canadian cities. He was quoted as saying, fans would yell, "Go back to the South. How come you're not picking cotton?" Nasty things like that. He said, "It never bothered me. I just wanted to be a hockey player. And if they couldn't accept that fact, then that was their problem, not mine." So, testament to grace and determination this man had. This is why he remains a role model to this day. Now, what became of Willie O'Ree's career? Well, that's kind of sad in a way, because Bruins management, Milt Schmidt, the future first GM ever of the Washington Capitals, was coaching the Bruins at the time, and he predicted good things for Willie O'Ree, and said they were grooming him for a much bigger role. And so he went into the 61 offseason thinking, well, he finally arrived. And what ended up happening was he got traded in the offseason to the Montreal Canadiens. And of course, anybody who knows about those teams, the Canadiens teams of the late 50s and early 60s, and how stacked their roster was, well, Willie didn't give up, but he knew he probably would never crack that lineup and get into another NHL game again, though he kept toiling for another 13 or 14 years in the minors. But unfortunately, he never got another shot at the National Hockey League because of that. And that's kind of sad. And what's worse is they never ever told him about the trade. They just traded him. They just sprung it on him. Never explained it to him, never bothered to call him or anything. So, kind of sad, but as he did with everything else, he took it all in stride, kept on going. Now, he also said his most proudest moment, his happiest moment ever, was in another game in the 61 season against those very same Montreal Canadiens, where he scored on a low shot just after getting around the Montreal defense, put a nice low hard shot into the corner of the net. It was on New Year's night in 1961, that in that very same 1961 season, and he ended up getting a 2-minute long standing ovation from the Boston Garden crowd. And he said he'd never been happier in his life. And the fans, they just stood up and they cheered him for 2 minutes straight, because, you know, here's this little guy, wasn't the biggest guy, got around the vaunted Montreal defense all by himself, practically, and scores this pretty good goal. So the Boston crowd showed their appreciation. He said that was the happiest moment of his career. Now, Willie ended up, of course, after that trade, he ended up knocking around the minors, spent the rest of his career in the old Western Hockey League, between 61 and 74, having four seasons of 30 or more goals, topping out with a high of 38 goals in the 64-65 season. Spent time with a lot of teams like the Los Angeles Blades, San Diego Gulls, and the Gulls actually retired his number, and it hangs to this day at the San Diego Sports Arena. I actually ended up playing. He was in pretty good shape. He was in decent enough shape. He played all the way up to when he was 43 years old. But that's the capper to his career. Now he is one of the representatives. He's a featured representative of the National Hockey League's Diversity Task Force. So you can see him on in any major event representing the NHL. He's involved with a lot of the NHL charities involving inner-city kids so that they can have a chance to participate in the game. Like I said, remains a role model to this day. Now, getting on with the place of those of African descent in the game today. There's still a lot of role models. So I'm just gonna spend the next few minutes going over a lot of players, a lot of folks who've made their contributions. I'm gonna try to get through this as quickly as I can, but I don't want to leave too many names out because there are a lot of great names here, a lot of great people who made contributions to the game. We're going to jump ahead another few years, and we're going to talk about a guy a little bit who played for the old World Hockey Association. And close to home, at least here, guy by the name of Alton White played for, among other teams, the Baltimore Blades of the old World Hockey Association. Why do I mention him other than he played for the only major professional Baltimore hockey team there ever was? Well, he was the first black hockey player to score a hat trick in a game. So there's some significant history there. Also very close to home, the second ever player of African descent was a guy by the name of Mike Marson. He was actually taken with the first pick in the second round of the 1974, it was then called the amateur draft, the NHL amateur draft. Mike Marson was taken in the 74 draft by, of all teams, the Washington Capitals. And, of course, he had to endure a lot of racism because not even, and, if you go to the Capitals Memories website, it's well documented. His teammates wouldn't even stick up for him sometimes. And that's how bad it got for there. And he actually ended up having, another teammate of African descent, Bill Riley. So it was the first time two players of African descent played in one game was when they first suited up, both for the Capitals. So now we're going to start to get towards some players that were able to stick long enough to put up some significant numbers, and the first of which was a guy by the name of Tony McKechnie, who actually got his start also in the World Hockey Association. He was set to sign his first big pro contract, one of his first big pro contracts with the old Birmingham Bulls. Well, Birmingham being in Alabama, as you can imagine, a lot of the fans had a big problem with a black man playing for their hockey team. And unfortunately, what ended up happening was the owner illegally terminated his contract because it was such a backlash. So, but Tony McKechnie, ended up making a name for himself, in the National Hockey League, playing with the Quebec Nordiques, Buffalo Sabres, and ended up retiring with the Detroit Red Wings, but not before scoring 40 goals first black player to do so, scoring 40 goals in a season in the 1988 season playing for the St. Louis Blues, playing on a line with Bernie Federko, the great Bernie Federko, Hall of Famer. Like I say, first player to put up some significant numbers. His final totals, 912 games played, 320 goals, 319 assists for 639 points. Now, jumping ahead to the a little bit more to the 80s, now you have even more great black players coming onto the scene. And, of course, be remiss if we didn't talk about Grant Fuhr, the great Grant Fuhr, goalie for all those Stanley Cup teams in the 80s for the Edmonton Oilers. Probably one of the best money goalies of his day, if not of all time. Of course, was the Vezina Trophy winner in 1988 as the top goalie in the league. So definitely have to mention him. All of these guys, it has to be noted, were all Canadians. Now, of course, the first African-American player was Val James, and he got his start with the San Jose Sharks. He didn't get in too many games, but he, of course, made history as the first African-American player to play in the National Hockey League. Another African-American who broke into the league, another player for the Washington Capitals, Mike Greer, born in Detroit, played his college hockey for the Boston University Terriers. And I first saw him on an ESPN special in the mid-80s called Black Ice. It was hosted by John Saunders of ESPN. And I saw this guy play, and I thought, wow, it'd be great to have a guy like that on our team. Sure enough, in his career, he ended up playing for the Capitals, and I love watching him play. Wasn't the most talented player, but he gave it his all every night. Very gritty, very tough player. So as far as the defensive aspects of the game, played it the way it should have. And he was so tough that he had chronic shoulder problems, but instead of halting his career, interrupting his career with surgery, he would just take it in stride and just pop his shoulder in and out of place as needed to deal with it. And he just sucked it up and dealt with the pain. That's how tough he was. Now, talked about a lot of players. I want to get into a little bit, before I forget, some non-players that made some contributions, starting with Jay Scherers. He was actually the first black referee in an NHL game. Very significant. So the league has also had someone in a position of authority refereeing a game as part of their history. Would like to see more of that, but at least they've had one. Haven't had a full-time coach in the NHL, but in the minor leagues, this guy by the name of John Paris Jr., first person of African descent to coach a professional hockey team, coach the Atlanta Knights. The former Atlanta Knights, former affiliate of the Tampa Bay Lightning. And speaking of leaders, wondering has an African player been before Jerome McGinley anyway, we'll get to him, a captain. Yes, they have. First one being Dirk Graham, captain the Chicago Blackhawks. And even coached them for a while. So actually, yes, the league has had a coach, an African descent coach. So they don't have one now, but they have had one in their history. And just looking at today, it's hard not to spot a player of African American or Canadian descent on a team. Of course, we have Joel Ward on the Capitals. I mentioned before, Jerome Iginla on the Calgary Flames, future Hall of Famer. Future Hall of Famer. Just recently scored his 500th career goal. As Ray Emery of the Chicago Blackhawks. Decent goalie there. Johnny Oduya, first European trained player of African descent in the NHL, and was recently traded from the Winnipeg Jets to the Chicago Blackhawks in a deadline deal. Speaking of the Jets, there's also Dustin Byfuglien, native of Minnesota. And we're just going to, the last name I wanted to mention, not part of the National Hockey League, but there is even a woman on this list. And her name is Angela James. And, best of all, she is the only person of African descent to captain a national team. She captained the Canadian national team. And not only that, along with Cammy Granato and Geraldine Heaney, became the first women to be inducted into the International Ice Hockey Federation Hall of Fame, IIHF Hall of Fame. So there you have it. You have on-ice officials, coaches, players, and even a woman who captained a national team. So you have people descended from Africa, people of color, who have made significant contributions across the board to the great sport of ice hockey. And I got to admit, I had a lot of fun doing the research for it. I wish I had more time to go into detail, some of the stories behind these careers and these lives. Just absolutely fascinating. But again, I want to thank, Dr. Garth Vaughn, Mike Walsh, Joe Peltier for their websites. If you want to read more about these stories, go to their websites and, Dr. Vaughn's site is birthplaceofhockey.com. Mike Walsh's site is missioncreep.com. Joe Peltier's site is greatesthockeylegends.com. It's three very good sites if you want to read more about the history of the contributions of these great people to the game. So we're out of time. I'm going to wrap it up. Went a little long today. Had a little bit more to talk about, but I'm going to wind it up today for the month. I'm going to shoot for the end of the month. We're going to really push for the playoffs. It's going to be the last couple weeks of the season. We'll see where the team's at, see where the Caps are at. Will they still be in it? Will they be out of it? Don't know. Keeping our fingers crossed, but that's where we're headed for now. And don't know what I'm going to do for a historical segment just yet, but I'll think of something. And I just want to thank Usual Suspects, Maltese Productions for their music. As I said, Dr. Vaughn, Mike Walsh, and Joe Peltier for their sites, contributions. Folks out there listening, thank you very much. Keeping things up. If you have a comment or question, I can be reached at blueliner77@gmail.com or at my blog, ourplaypoint.blogspot.com. And as per usual, we're going to have my good friend Andy Myers take us out. See you.
That's setting up Maroon with Tier 1, 2 and 1 on the Mammoth. Across the Tier 1, back to Maroon Jordan! Maroon to Tier 1 of Maroon! Oh, my God. the cry of Maroon once again rings across the land. Modest pilot Mason Sears shows that he's put ball on it. That is Maroon.
Hi, it's me again. Little bit of overtime here. I just wanted to take about a minute to clear something up. Now, those of you listening, I don't know if you'll take anything away or what you'll take away from especially the historical segment. I at least hope you learned something new if you weren't familiar with it. But I certainly didn't want to give the impression that it was all fun and smiles for these folks who were breaking ground in a sport that you got to admit out of all the four major sports in North America is predominantly white, and that's no stretch. But I wanted to just convey that, you know. I'm certainly not trying to give that impression. Willie O'Ree said as much, that his struggles weren't much compared to Jackie Robinson, but by no means does that at all meant to imply that Mr. O'Ree did not face at least some of the resistance that a Jackie Robinson faced. Racism was then and still is now very real. And I'm not trying to get on a soapbox about it. I'm just talking reality here. I'm talking about what still exists in the world. And I realize that one man's accomplishments in a sport played on ice may not mean a whole lot to a whole lot of people. But the reason I'm putting it out there is because if this one man can do what he did, not only with a physical handicap, but with the disadvantage that is brought on by the evil that is racism, then I think that's not only something to talk about, it's something to celebrate. Now again, was it easy for Willie O'Ree and those that followed him? Certainly not. And I would never, ever make it out to be anything less than what it is. But I think he would be the first to say that if, because of his efforts while he was a player and his efforts on the NHL Diversity Task Force, if that has anything to do with an inner city child, disadvantaged child, picking up a hockey stick, putting on equipment, having access to that equipment, getting time in a rink, and being able to learn what it is to play hockey, then he would be the first to say that he's done his job, that he's made a mark, his mark, on this world. And that's what it's all about. And what I'm trying to say is that hockey is more than a bunch of people
than 12 people putting on paraphernalia, as the great Danny Gallivan used to call it, and running into each other and trying to score goals. Hockey is more than that. Sport is much bigger than that. And for one man to defy this ridiculous imaginary barrier that we put up simply because the color of the skin of that person is different, then that's the real triumph. So not trying to get on a real high horse here or anything like that, but I just wanted to put that out there at the end, because anybody that says, you know, they had it easy while overcoming racism, well, it's just not true. But at the same time, it's no small accomplishment, even in a sport like ice hockey. And that's all I wanted to say. So once again, I appreciate your time and your listening, and we'll catch you next month.